You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Russia continues its strikes on Ukraine as President Biden sends more military aid before Trump takes office next month. Meanwhile, Ukraine faces a cold, dark winter after Russian strikes destroyed about half of the country's energy infrastructure. We'll go to Kyiv to speak with leading Ukrainian human rights lawyer, Oleksandra Matveichuk. Then to Gaza, which is entering its second winter under attack from Israel, and talks to reach a ceasefire deal with Hamas appear to have stalled.
Due to the rain yesterday, water gathered over the worn-out tents and broke the wood. And water went down on those asleep, and we got up at 3 a.m. to try to gather what is left of the tent. This is our situation.
We'll get an update on the Gaza ceasefire talks with Gershon Baskin, a longtime Israeli-backed channel negotiator with Hamas, whose memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. And as the sixth displaced Palestinian baby has died from hypothermia in Gaza, we'll speak with two doctors who worked in Gaza hospitals, including one who left just this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy Goodman will be back next year. That is, on Thursday. The United Nations warns Israeli attacks on hospitals have left Gaza's medical system on the brink of total collapse, with a catastrophic effect on Palestinians' access to health care. The new report by the UN Human Rights Office documents 136 Israeli attacks on 39 medical facilities. It was released just days after Israeli forces raided the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza last Friday, destroying much of the facility and arresting staff and patients at gunpoint. There are growing calls internationally for Israel to release the hospital's director, Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, after he was abducted by Israeli forces and reportedly taken to a military detention camp with his leg badly injured. Amnesty International said on social media, quote, "Hospitals and health workers are not targets. The international community, especially Israel's allies, must act to bring an end to Israel's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza." This comes as at least seven Palestinians, including six babies living in displaced camps in Gaza, have died from the cold. And relentless winter rainstorms have flooded thousands of tents of forcibly displaced people. Sabrine Abu Shanab is a displaced mother of three, struggling to keep her family warm and fed in a tattered tent encampment in Deir al-Bala.
It rained, and although it was mild and not heavy rain, look what happened to us. We were flooded. The wooden poles of the tent broke, we barely fixed them. The water seeped inside and into the mattresses and my children's clothes. They were sleeping and soaked wet to their underwear. I swear, everything is soaked, the blankets, the pillows, everything.
Israel's military says it intercepted a missile fired toward Tel Aviv by Yemen's Houthis late on Monday. The missile triggered air raid sirens and halted takeoffs and landings at Ben Gurion Airport for about an hour. It was the fifth such attack by Houthis over the past week, coming just days after Israel bombed the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah and the capital Sana'a, killing at least six people and injuring dozens. Among those who narrowly survived the attack on Sana'a was Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, head of the World Health Organization, who was just meters away from a blast from an Israeli bomb dropped on the airport. On Monday, Dr. Tedros called on both the Houthis and the Israelis to stop their attacks.
The attack inflicted needless death, injury, panic, chaos, and damage, and was another reminder of the growing threat faced by civilians, humanitarians, and health workers in war zones around the world. This must stop.
On Monday, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations delivered what he called a final warning to Yemen's Houthis, saying they could soon, quote, share the same miserable fate as Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Bashar al-Assad in Syria. France's defense ministry says its warplanes bombed Islamic State positions in central Syria on Sunday. The French attacks follow several U.S. strikes on IS positions following the ouster of longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad in early December. In related news, Syria's new foreign minister has held his first diplomatic meetings. Assad Hassan al-Shibani was named Syria's top diplomat on December 21st by the interim government. On Monday, he welcomed Kuwait's foreign minister for talks about ending international sanctions and pledging closer ties to countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council. Al-Shibani also met with Ukraine's foreign minister to discuss strengthening ties after decades of Russian support for Bashar al-Assad's rule.
There will be strategic contributions and partnerships between us and Ukraine on political, economic, and social levels. We also have scientific collaborations that we will restart with Ukraine. We once again welcome the Ukrainian foreign minister.
The Syrian and Ukrainian diplomats also discussed the fate of a Russian naval base and airbase in Syria, Russia's only two military bases outside of the former Soviet Union. Russia and Ukraine have completed a prisoner swap, repatriating more than 300 prisoners of war in a deal brokered by the United Arab Emirates ahead of the start of the new year. On the Ukrainian side, the swap included some prisoners who'd been held for over 2 years, including soldiers who defended Snake Island in the Black Sea and others who held out for months defending the southern city of Mariupol from Russia's invasion.
My son is 5 years old now. The last time I saw him, he was 2 years old. That's why my son probably didn't recognize me. I used to have a beard and hair. He was 2 years old. I lost 44 pounds.
Ukrainian officials say Moscow has released nearly 4,000 soldiers and civilians in deals with Kyiv since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Meanwhile, President Biden on Monday announced another $2.5 billion in U.S. military aid to Ukraine. The package includes air defense missiles, munitions for rocket and artillery systems, anti-tank weapons, and more. Separately, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen announced $3.4 billion in economic assistance to Ukraine. Since Russia's invasion nearly 3 years ago, Congress has approved $175 billion in total assistance to Ukraine. Biden is rushing aid before President-elect Trump takes office in 3 weeks. On the campaign trail, Trump expressed skepticism about sending more aid and repeatedly pledged to end the war in his first 24 hours in office. In Kenya, police in Nairobi on Monday fired tear gas at protesters demanding the release of dozens of government critics who've been abducted by armed groups in recent months. Protesters blame Kenya's police and intelligence service for the disappearances. Human rights groups have condemned the extrajudicial arrests carried out as Kenyan President William Ruto cracks down on nationwide anti-government protests. Ruto previously called the disappearances, quote, fake news. Over 50 anti-abduction protesters were arrested Monday, including opposition lawmaker Okiye Omtatah. The Pentagon has repatriated one of the first Guantanamo Bay prisoners to Tunisia after more than 2 decades of incarceration without trial. Rida bin Saleh al-Yazidi had been held at the notorious U.S. military prison in Cuba since it opened in 2002. He was abducted by Pakistani soldiers near the Afghan border in 2001 and accused of being an al-Qaeda fighter, but was never charged with a crime. Al-Yazidi was cleared for release more than a decade ago. 26 prisoners remain at Guantanamo Bay 16 years after Barack Obama pledged to close the prison in his first year as president. A federal appeals court has rejected President-elect Trump's attempt to overturn a 2023 jury verdict that found him liable for sexually abusing writer E. Jean Carroll and then defaming her as Trump repeatedly denied the accusations. At the time, a jury awarded Carroll $5 million in compensatory and punitive damages. Carroll accused Trump of raping her in the dressing room of a Bergdorf Goodman department store in Manhattan in the mid-1990s. Trump has continued his attacks on Carroll, recently reposting a photo of Carroll on his Truth social media platform with the caption, quote, "Should a woman go to jail for falsely accusing a man of rape?" Afghanistan's Taliban leaders have announced the closure of all national and international NGOs that currently employ women. The latest crackdown comes 2 years after Taliban officials issued a rule that banned Afghan women from working at NGOs, including humanitarian relief agencies, under the threat of losing their license. This also comes as the Taliban has prohibited the construction of new residential buildings with windows that overlook areas where women might be sitting or standing. Taliban officials also said existing windows with such views should be blocked. A Taliban government spokesperson said in a statement, quote, "Seeing women working in kitchens, in courtyards, or collecting water from wells can lead to obscene acts." And press freedom groups are demanding that Iran release Italian journalist Cecilia Sala, who was arrested in Tehran on December 19th and has since been held in solitary confinement inside Tehran's Evin prison. Sala, who works for the newspaper Il Foglio and an Italian podcast company, had entered Iran on a regular journalist visa. Just days before her arrest, she filed this report from Tehran.
Sono tornata in Iran, il posto dove più volevo tornare.
I have returned to Iran, the place I most wanted to come back to. Since the last time I was here, many things have changed. One is that hundreds of thousands of women no longer wear the veil, or at least not in the way the law dictates. And they are not afraid of foreigner like me taking their picture of the Chinese-made smart cameras scattered throughout the city, scanning their faces or sending alerts to the police.
Iranian authorities have, for the first time, confirmed the arrest of Cecilia Sala amid signs they may be angling for a prisoner swap. A day before Sala's arrest, police in Italy detained a 38-year-old Iranian man accused of working with Iran's Revolutionary Guards for possible extradition to the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy Goodman will be back Thursday. We begin today's show in Ukraine, where Russia has launched multiple missile and drone attacks today on the capital Kyiv and other regions. Ukraine is already facing a cold, dark winter after Russian strikes destroyed about half of the country's energy infrastructure. On Monday, President Biden said the United States will send nearly $2.5 billion more in weapons to Ukraine before President-elect Donald Trump returns to office in a few weeks. The package includes air defense missiles, munitions for rocket and artillery systems, anti-tank weapons, and more. Separately, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen announced $3.4 billion in economic assistance to Ukraine. Since Russia's invasion nearly 3 years ago, Congress has approved $175 billion in total assistance to Ukraine. Biden is rushing aid before President-elect Trump takes office in 3 weeks. On the campaign trail, Trump expressed skepticism about sending more aid and repeatedly pledged to end the war in his first 24 hours in office. This comes as Russia and Ukraine have completed a prisoner swap, repatriating more than 300 prisoners of war in a deal brokered by the United Arab Emirates ahead of the new year. On the Ukrainian side, the swap included some prisoners who'd been held for over 2 years, including soldiers who defended Snake Island in the Black Sea and others who held out for months defending the southern city of Mariupol from Russia's invasion.
My son is 5 years old now. The last time I saw him, he was 2 years old. That's why my son probably didn't recognize me. I used to have a beard and hair. He was 2 years old. I lost 44 pounds.
Meanwhile, today marks 25 years since Russian President Vladimir Putin became president of Russia. For more, we're joined in Kyiv by Oleksandra Medvedchuk, leading Ukrainian human rights lawyer. She's worked with the Tribunal for Putin Initiative to document over 80,000 war crimes committed by Russia since its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. She leads the human rights organization Center for Civil Liberties, which was awarded the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize. In the same year, she received the Right Livelihood Award. Her recent piece for The Hill is headlined, Ukraine faces a cold, dark winter after Russia's energy strikes. Oleksandra, welcome back to Democracy Now! We're speaking to you in Kyiv. Could you describe what the situation there is on the ground as the capital city of Ukraine comes under attack from Russia?
This night we have the next rockets and drone attack to Kyiv and to other cities and settlements in the country. And this become quite regular phenomena. Russia want to destroy completely Ukraine energy system and to make millions of Ukrainians to face the winter without heating, electricity, water, light, and internet connection. What I want to say that due to the work of ordinary people who repair this civil infrastructure, we are able to meet this new year Eve with light. And this is a bright symbol of Ukrainian resilience.
And could you explain, Oleksandra, your organization has been documenting war crimes. You're working with this tribunal on Putin to document war crimes, 80,000. I mean, if you could just give a sense of what kinds of crimes have been occurring in Ukraine for the last almost 3 years since Russia's invasion.
I'm a human rights lawyer, which means that I apply in the law to defend people and human dignity for many years. But now I found myself in a situation when the law doesn't work. What we document? We document how Russian troops destroying residential buildings, schools, churches, museums and hospitals. They're taking evacuation corridors. They're torturing people in filtration camps. They're forcibly taking Ukrainian children to Russia. They're abducting, robbing, raping, and killing civilians in the occupied territories. And the entire UN system of peace and security can't stop it. Russia uses war crimes as the methods of warfare. Russia instrumentalized the pain. Russia used the pain as a tool how to break people's resistance and to occupy the country.
Oleksandra, you know, we last spoke to you, in fact, just days after the invasion in February 2022. I mean, conditions have been so brutal. You're in Kyiv, which has come under constant attack. Explain why you made the decision to stay in Kyiv all this time and how you and those who you know in the city have coped with the power blackouts and other things that have happened as Russia has continued its assault.
I decided to stay because this is my home. This is my country. This is my family. And we will fight for our freedom and for our human dignity. I remember this time very clearly because not just Putin, but also our international partners were confident that Ukraine has no potential to resist to such enormous opposing power. And I remember how even international organizations evacuated their personnel, but ordinary people remained. And ordinary people started to do extraordinary things. It were ordinary people who helped to survive under artillery fires. It were ordinary people who took people out from the ruined cities. It were ordinary people who broke through the encirclement to provide humanitarian aid. And you know what? Suddenly, it became obvious that ordinary people fighting for their freedom and human dignity are stronger than even the second army in the world.
Well, let's talk, Alexandra, about what you think the prospects are for some kind of a peace or ceasefire deal. Moscow has recently rejected a peace plan by U.S. President-elect Trump to end the war, which proposed delaying Kyiv's NATO membership in exchange for a ceasefire. This is Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov speaking last week.
We cannot be satisfied with empty talk. So far, all we hear is talk about the need to come up with some kind of truce, and it is not particularly hidden that this truce is needed in order to gain time to continue pumping Ukraine with weapons so that they can get themselves in order, carry out additional mobilization, and so on. A truce is a road to nowhere. We need final legal agreements that will fix all the conditions for ensuring the security of the Russian Federation and, of course, the legitimate security interests of our neighbors, but in the context that will secure the impossibility of violating these agreements in an internationally legal manner.
So that's Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Alexandra, if you could respond to what he said and what Ukraine's demands are, what do you expect might happen once Trump comes into office in just a few weeks? And do you think Ukraine should be making concessions? And if so, what concessions?
I'm not surprised with this response from Russia because Putin doesn't want peace. Putin started this war not just to capture one more piece of Ukrainian land. Putin started this war to occupy and to destroy the whole Ukraine and to go further, to attack next countries and to forcibly restore Russian Empire. And the problem is that after 2.5 years of large-scale invasion, Putin didn't refuse from this goal. Because human life is the cheapest resources in Russian state. And we have to take this goal seriously in all our strategies and all our visions how to stop Russian war of aggression against Ukraine. And this means that we have to design a real security guarantees which make Putin's goal not just to postpone it in time, but make it impossible for Putin to achieve. And this is important because people in Ukraine want peace much more than anyone else because the war is horrible. But peace doesn't come when country which was invaded stop resisting to Russian aggression. That's not peace. That's occupation. And occupation is horrible. It's just the same war, but in another form, because Russian occupation means torture, rapes, enforced disappearances, denial of your own identity, forcible adoption of your children, filtration camps and mass graves. And that's why we have no other choice. Because if we stop resisting to Russian aggression, it will be no more us.
And what do you expect with Trump coming into office in a few weeks? What changes in U.S. policy do you anticipate? And do you think that Trump being in office may force Ukraine to give up territory in exchange for a peace deal with Russia? Trump has said he would end the war within 24 hours of coming into office.
It's very difficult for me to predict the policy of next president administration. I hope that Trump will use this famous Reagan principle to the peace through strength. And once again, we have to take the real goal of Russia seriously. Putin doesn't want some more part of Ukrainian Donbas. Putin wants to achieve his historical goal. To forcibly restore Russian Empire. He think about his legacy. So it's not about territories at all. But for us, for Ukrainians, it's also not just about territories because we are fighting for people who live there. It's our people. It's our relatives. It's our families. It's our citizens. We can't leave them alone for torture and death under Russian occupation. We have no moral rights. We have to return the human dimension of this war when we discuss in these difficult geopolitical issues.
And Oleksandra, what about the role of the European Union, the key countries in the European, France, Germany, their role in pushing for a ceasefire and also the amount of aid that they've been giving to Ukraine, whether you think that's adequate and what you anticipate happening in the future as the EU also cuts back on aid?
It's very difficult for me to provide expertise on the military assistance because I'm not a military expert. But what I see, because I often travel not just to Washington, but to Berlin, to Paris, to Rome, to Brussels, I see that politicians in the European Union started to understand that their countries are safe only because Ukrainians still fighting. I see this even in our human rights work. What do I mean? Russia is empire, and empire has a center, but has no borders. And empire always try to expand. And when I interviewed people who survived Russian captivity, they told me that Russians see their future like this, that first we'll occupy Ukraine, and then, together with you, we will go to conquer in other countries. And the process of forcible mobilization, Ukrainian citizens to Russian army, all these years is going on in the occupied territories. So once again, people in European Union are safe only because Ukrainians are still fighting with Russian aggression and don't let Putin to go further.
And I want to go back to something that we mentioned earlier, which is this prisoner swap that's just taken place. Russia and Ukraine have swapped more than 300 prisoners of war in a mass exchange brokered by the United Arab Emirates. If you could comment on what you think the significance of this is and what's known about who remain in Russian captivity, including civilians, and then also address Russia's targeting of journalists. One case is Ukrainian journalist Victoria Roschaya, who died in Russian detention earlier this year.
I work with the topic of illegally detained civilians and prisoners of the war for 10 years. I personally interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people who survived in Russian captivity, and they told me how they were beaten, raped, smashed into wooden boxes, their fingers were cut, their nails were turned away, their nails were drilled, they were electrically shocked through their own genitalia. One woman told me how her eye was dug out with a spoon, because Russia ignored not just all provisions of international humanitarian law, Russia ignored all senses of humanity. So that's why yesterday, prisoner swap, it was so important for all people in Ukraine because we released more than 180 people who will celebrate this holiday with their families. And this is extremely important, as well as thousands and thousands of prisoners of the war and illegally detained civilians. Among them, a lot of women are still in Russian captivity. And let me tell a little bit about my friend and colleague Victoria Roschina, which you mentioned. She was a Ukrainian journalist, extremely brave. She worked in occupied territories because she thought that this is her journalist obligation to be there with the people who were alone with the occupiers. She was just 27 years old, and she died in September in Russian prison after illegally arrest. And Russians for several times refused to return her body to her family, because her body probably can tell more about what happened with her, why she was dead. And I ask myself, if we can't press Russia to return the dead body of Ukrainian journalist to her family as international community, how we can to protect freedom of speech in the world at all?
And Alexandra, finally, today marks 25 years since Putin has been president of Russia. Your reflections on that, and of course, this is the last day of the year, 2024. What do you hope will happen next year in 2025? You wrote in your recent piece in The Hill, despite these horrific war crimes, the spirit of the Ukrainian people is unbroken.
Let me quote my Russian human rights colleagues. They told that Putin, he's a big ear. He hears what Russians want, and he tried to implement it with this war to restore the force of this Russian empire forcibly and to demonstrate Russian people's so-called Russian glory. And that is why the democratic success of Ukraine, it's so important, because it's not just a war between two states. This is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. And only success of Ukraine will provide a chance for democratic future for Russia itself. Because Russian people, they can tolerate war criminal being their president, but Russian people will not tolerate loser war criminal.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us. Alexandra Matvichuk, leading Ukrainian human rights lawyer and head of the human rights organization Center for Civil Liberties, which in 2022 was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And she is also the recipient of the Right Livelihood Award. Her recent piece for The Hill is headlined, Ukraine Faces a Cold, Dark Winter After Russia's Energy Strike. She joined us from Kyiv. Next up, Gaza is entering its second winter under attack from Israel, and talks to reach a ceasefire deal with Hamas appear to have stalled. We'll get an update on the ceasefire talks and speak with two doctors who've worked at Gaza hospitals this year, including one who just left. All that and more coming up. By Hamza al-Din. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to Gaza, which is entering its second winter under Israel's relentless war, and talks to reach a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas appear to have stalled. This comes as a new report by the Israeli Health Ministry is set to be submitted to the United Nations this week that alleges hostages held in Gaza have faced torture, including sexual and psychological abuse, starvation, burns, and medical neglect. Meanwhile, the abuse and psychological torture of Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons and camps are also a focus of international mediators working to secure a ceasefire that could include the release of thousands detained during and before the Gaza war began in return for Israeli hostages. A new report by Reuters found that amid the push for a ceasefire, Palestinians released from Israeli jails bear mental and physical scars. This is former detainee and Palestinian bodybuilder Muazzaz Obayat.
Life in jail since October 7th is a life that no human on earth can imagine in general, especially in the prison of Negev, which is like Guantanamo. It is a prison in the Negev desert, down to the bottom of Palestine on the map. This prison is isolated from the world. The Israeli forces act in the most disgusting and tough torture on earth against isolated detainees, handcuffed, hungry and ill.
Well, for more, we're joined by Gershon Buskin, Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization, a human rights advocacy group. For years, he's been a back-channel negotiator with Hamas in ceasefire deals, including throughout Israel's current war on Gaza and in 2011, when he helped negotiate the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit from Hamas captivity in exchange for the release of 1,027 Palestinian prisoners. His memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. Gershon Buskin, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could begin by talking about the status of the talks right now and what you understand is holding up an agreement.
Right, the status of the talks is that they have been speaking for months about the deal that was presented by President Biden in the end of May, a deal for a six-week ceasefire during which time about 30 or 32 Israeli hostages would be released in exchange for an agreed number of Palestinian prisoners. The belief is that the ceasefire would continue into a second six-week period during which time more hostages would be released. But what we know is that the Israelis are demanding Hamas to present a list of hostages that they would release, including young people that Hamas wants to hold on to the second part of the deal or the final part of the deal. And the Israelis are insisting on that release. From my talks with Israeli negotiators, what I understand is that there's an expectation that in about 3 weeks from now, when President Trump enters the White House, there would be a deal, maybe because President Trump would tell Prime Minister Netanyahu that it's time to make a deal. Until then, it's quite evident that Netanyahu doesn't want to make a comprehensive deal that would bring all the hostages home, because that would require Israel to end the war and to withdraw from Gaza, something that Netanyahu has said repeatedly that he's not ready to do.
Well, let's go to, you know, the comments that have been made about Netanyahu being the principal obstacle to an agreement. People who say that he has repeatedly sabotaged ceasefire negotiations and that he's doing so precisely to save his political career. Earlier this month, as word was circulating that a ceasefire deal was imminent, Netanyahu told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "I'm not going to agree to end the war before we remove Hamas. We're not going to leave them in power in Gaza, 30 miles from Tel Aviv. It's not going to happen." In response to his remarks, Israeli opposition minister Yair Lapid said in a radio interview, quote, "Netanyahu doesn't want a deal because of his politics. He's doing the same trick he's done before. The negotiations are progressing and becoming possible. And then he goes to the foreign media and explains that he won't stop the war and signals to Hamas that there's no reason to make an agreement with him." Netanyahu has also been criticized by the families of hostages who say he's sacrificing their lives for his own political purposes. At a protest last weekend, a family member addressed his pleas directly to incoming U.S. President Donald Trump.
"Mr. President, sir, you are the only one who can pressure Netanyahu. Please do not agree to a partial deal. That is a death sentence to those who stay behind, and it will not bring an end to the war. Don't allow Netanyahu to continue torpedoing the deal. The statements made by Netanyahu and his newly appointed defense minister Katz regarding retained Israeli military control over the Gaza Strip and continuing the war serve only the most extreme factions in Netanyahu's government."
So, Gershon Buskin, if you could talk about the kind of pressure that's being brought to bear on Netanyahu from within Israel itself to come to an agreement so that the hostages can be released and this brutal assault on Gaza ended.
You know, one of the chief negotiators told me months ago that Netanyahu here is the sole decision maker on this issue. And this is quite clear. There's very little that the families of hostages have been able to do. We've been participating in demonstrations every single week. There are demonstrations that take place every single day. But Netanyahu and his political machine have maneuvered the issue of the hostages to be politicized so that there are people who believe that if you're calling for a deal and ending the war, you're in fact a traitor to Israel. Here the big problem is what happens to Gaza the day after the war, because I think that the vast majority of Palestinians, certainly in Gaza, don't want to see Hamas in place, but there's no plan for what to do with Gaza when Israel would withdraw from the Gaza Strip. So we have a problem on both sides here. There needs to be a solution where Hamas would give up control of Gaza. They have said that they're willing to give up control to a professional technocratic civilian government, but there's no one around who can seem to put the sides together, or at least the Palestinians amongst themselves together with the other Arab states, to come up with a plan for how this war ends, how Israel is forced to withdraw from Gaza, how the hostages are released, and how Palestinian prisoners are released. This is a big puzzle that needs some mastermind to put together. Maybe President Trump can do it, because he maybe is the only person in the world who can effectively apply pressure on Netanyahu.
Well, Gershon, if we could talk about this, I mean, the role, what precisely will happen in Gaza after this war ends. Netanyahu is insisting that Hamas must go. But as many have pointed out, Hamas is already effectively destroyed very close to being destroyed as a military force. Its chief officers have been killed. Weapon stashes have been destroyed. Tunnels have been damaged in their bunkers. So, you know, all these things seem indisputably true. So what does it mean for Hamas to be further ousted, what they should all leave Gaza? It's unclear what precisely that means. And I want to go to what, the protester whose voice we played earlier, whom he was referring to, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz, what he said or implied the role of the IDF would be following the end of the war, namely that they would retain security control over Gaza.
Security will remain in the hands of the IDF. IDF will be able to act in any way to remove threats, prevent tunneling, prevent terrorist infrastructure, prevent terrorist organization and attempts to harm the state of Israel or IDF soldiers. It is clear what we saw in the area of the penetrating tunnels, what we saw in the area of threats. While we saw the heroic war that eliminated these capabilities, how will we make sure it will not happen again? How will we ensure that security control will be in the hands of the IDF, which will be allowed to act everywhere to prevent threats?
So if you could comment on that, Gershon, and if it seems, as some have suggested, that Israel is in fact solidifying its position, it's not willing to compromise on this continued Israeli control, in some sense, over at least parts of Gaza, and also this insistence that Hamas be removed.
Right. My message to the Israeli people and to the members of the Israeli government is that as long as the Israeli army remains in Gaza, Hamas will remain in power in Gaza. They have an endless supply of new recruits from young people who have no life, have no future, who can easily be recruited to Hamas. And as long as Israeli soldiers are present in Gaza, they have targets to hit. Even if they can't do effective damage to the state of Israel, they can't do another October 7th. As long as there's an Israeli presence in Gaza, there are targets there. Israel needs to understand that it needs to defend its border from the border, not within the Palestinian territory. And I think the entire international community, including us Israelis who want to live in peace with our Palestinian neighbors, we need to put the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the agenda again and make sure that this is the last war that we fight. We can't keep doing this. There needs to be an independent Palestinian state next to Israel, but that independent Palestinian state needs to be committed to living in peace with Israel. That's not occupying it. That's enabling the Palestinians to have freedom, liberation, and dignity, and that will grant Israel security. We all need the security, the liberation, the freedom, and the dignity, but that can only be done in a solution which is going to grant both people the right to self-determination.
Well, Gershon, if you could also say, I mean, you know, Trump has said, you said he might be the only person who can get Netanyahu to agree. But you've also said in a previous interview that it's really not clear what the U.S. could do, what pressure it could bring or do in Gaza that Israel has not already done, either to Hamas or Gaza. So what do you foresee him doing, I guess, short of canceling aid or withdrawing it?
Right. If President Trump is serious about what he said on the night that he was elected, that he's not a man who will make new wars, he will end these wars, including the Israeli-Palestinian wars, then the effective pressure needs to be applied on Israel and on Netanyahu. And unlike the period of the time, the Biden administration or the Obama administration, with Trump in government, Netanyahu has no one to turn to in the United States who can help him. It will be Trump facing off Netanyahu. Now, the question is, we all know that Trump is unpredictable. We don't know what he will do. But if he was serious about this comment that he will end wars, then that means that he's going to have to tell Israel that it has to withdraw from Gaza. It has to withdraw from the occupied territories. It has to enable a Palestinian state to be established next to Israel. But the Americans need to be firm with the Palestinians as well. They can no longer have an armed struggle as part of their strategy for dealing with Israel. We need to get these two parties to sit down and face off each other with mutual recognition and respect and dignity and security.
But of course, Gershon, the occupation of Gaza did not begin following, October 2023. That's been in place for years. So what guarantee do Palestinians have? And the occupation was a brutal and is a brutal occupation. What guarantee do Palestinians have that even if they were to make concessions, that their position would be any stronger than it was prior to October 2023? Those conditions having led to Hamas's also brutal attack on Israel. But nevertheless, there were conditions prior to October 2023 that produced the conditions to which Palestinians were protesting.
For sure. The war didn't begin on October 7th. The conflict didn't begin on October 7th of last year. This is the result of many, many decades of conflict between these two parties. Honestly, there are no guarantees that the Palestinians will get. No one can give them those guarantees. No one will give them the guarantees. The question that I ask is, isn't it time to change the strategy? They've been doing the same thing for so many years now and not getting the results that they want. Maybe they need to adopt a new strategy. There's no question that the Palestinians are right in demanding that they don't live under occupation. The occupation has to end, and Israel is wrong. And while Hamas committed war crimes on October 7th, Israel's been committing war crimes in Gaza every day since. So the question here is not what kind of guarantees can be provided. The question is, can we come up with a strategy that's going to produce better results than the one that we've been using for the last 76 years?
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Gershon Baskin, Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization. Of course, we're going to continue to follow this issue. He's a longtime back channel negotiator with Hamas in ceasefire deals. His memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. Next up, the sixth displaced Palestinian baby has died from hypothermia in Gaza. We'll speak with two doctors who treated children in Gaza hospitals, including one who just left last week.
It's a hard life, fight against the weak. It's a hard life, threatened by your freedom beyond your way. Things are gonna change. It's a hard to be seen, it's a hard life. We were born to lead, I'll lead on your way. Things are gonna change.
Hard Life by Salt. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show in Gaza, where relentless winter rainstorms have flooded thousands of tents of forcibly displaced Palestinians.
Due to the rain yesterday, water gathered over the worn-out tents and broke the wood. And water went down on those asleep, and we got up at 3 a.m. to
try to gather what is left of the tent. This is our situation.
This comes as at least six infants and one adult living in displaced camps in Gaza have died from the cold as winter temperatures drop. Meanwhile, a United Nations report published today finds that Israeli strikes on and near hospitals in the Gaza Strip have, quote, pushed the healthcare system to the brink of total collapse with catastrophic effect on Palestinians' access to health and medical care. The world is still calling on Israel to release Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp, after he was detained in a raid on the hospital by Israeli forces and reportedly taken to a detention camp with his leg badly injured. For more, we're joined by two doctors who worked in Gaza this year. In Amman, Jordan, Dr. Mimi Said is an emergency medicine physician. She just left Gaza for the second time this year. She volunteered for 4 weeks at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus and Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. Also with us is her colleague, Dr. Firoz Sidwa, a trauma surgeon who volunteered at the European Hospital in Khan Yunus in the early spring. His piece last month for Foreign Policy is headlined, "The U.S. must support Gaza before winter, seasonal rains and flooding portend further humanitarian catastrophe." We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Dr. Mimi Sayed, if you could begin, you were just there in Gaza. Describe where you were and the conditions that you've seen in the hospitals that remain where you worked.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yes, I actually just got back yesterday. So, the conditions are terrible. They were terrible in August, but winter has kind of brought in a new level of destruction. The children that I saw just disproportionately affected by this, the malnourishment, the contamination of the water, everything is just tenfold now because of the dropping temperatures. There's the same type of airstrikes and the missiles and the targeting of children that I witnessed again. We saw the same type of shrapnel injuries, traumatic amputations, blunt trauma, and then open skull wounds of children. Just the same type of brutal aggression.
And while you were in Gaza, you gave an interview to Sky News, Dr. Sayed, and you said while in Gaza, you said, quote, "Humanity is ending here," that's what you see, humanity ending here in Gaza. If you could elaborate further on, in particular, this issue of water, why it is that so much of the water supply is contaminated and what this means for people in Gaza, in hospitals, and in particular, the most vulnerable, children, infants, and the elderly.
Yeah, I mean, I had an opportunity this time to actually walk around in the camps and talk to the families and actually visit inside of the tents, just deep inside those encampments. And the living conditions are just deplorable. I mean, they are not compatible with human life. The contamination of the water is very high. I spoke to the infection control manager there that takes care of the water filtration system. And he was explaining to me that the filtration, the chlorine, the solvents that they need, the membranes that they need, none of that is available. The water is coming up, I mean, literally from a hose. Children fill like these dirty plastic containers, and it's supposed to be filtered again, but those filters that are in front of residential areas, the power is generated by fuel, which of course is not available. So they end up drinking this water that's actually just meant for like washing and such, but that's leading to this chronic diarrhea that children have, especially small babies that are affected so much by this. Every child there that I saw in the emergency department had diarrhea. And then it leads with the malnourishment on top of that, it's leading to organ failure, things like kidney failure we'd see in children. I mean, it's rates that you don't typically see in other countries. It's all because of this water, very high in salt content. You can't filter that out. It's seawater. And of course, the elderly are at the same risk of becoming ill, critically ill that way.
And Dr. Feroz Sidva, if you could talk about, you've made remarks to the effect that hundreds of thousands of toddlers and elderly could potentially die in Gaza in February or by February, and respond specifically to the raid on Kamal Adwan Hospital, the last remaining functional major hospital in northern Gaza, and what the effects of that will be, and the fact that, of course, its director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, has been detained, his leg badly injured.
Yeah, as far as we know, Dr. Abu Safia has been detained. Don't know where he is. Don't know what's being done to him. May never find out. Who knows? And yeah, Kamal Adwan's been destroyed. It's really it had barely been a functional hospital in any sense for months. It's been under siege for at least a month. The Israelis, you know, there was one point at which it really just got incredibly sadistic. The Israelis allowed the only delivery of supplies during this time, and then tank shelled the little warehouse that it was put into in the hospital. It's pretty sadistic at this point. And the U.S. goes along with it, so we can't really blame the Israelis for it. We're the ones allowing it to happen. But in terms of the public health situation in Gaza, I think it's exactly like Dr. Syed just described. And it's what Dr. Parkinson and I wrote about in Foreign Policy, like you mentioned. You know, Gaza is a half child population. The entire, you know, 90% of the population is homeless, meaning their homes have been physically destroyed or they've just been displaced from them. But regardless, they live in temporary shelters. As you heard from as the listeners heard from the, at the beginning of the program, when it rains, these shelters don't provide any protection from the rain and the flooding that happens every year in Gaza. And so now the temperature is quite chilly. Well, the adults can survive a 50-degree winter, but even adults, not if they're wet constantly. I mean, you're talking about being wet for 3 months straight. And furthermore, they're not just wet, they're living in a land that literally doesn't have a sewage system anymore. It's one of the most crowded places in the world. The Mwasi, where most of these people are, the 1.8 million people that are concentrated there, are living in a place that literally has no sewage system. 1.8 million people are living in a place that has 121 toilets. This is just outrageous. And then on top of that, the Israelis aren't even allowing soap to be brought into Gaza. So it's not hard to figure out what's going to happen when all of that is put together. It's very likely that tens or even hundreds of thousands of people are going to die of the combination of malnutrition, displacement, exposure to the elements, and hypothermia this winter. And at this point, there isn't actually anything that can be done about it.
And Dr. Sidva, if you could comment also, I mean, given the many, many reasons that people are dying prematurely in Gaza, hypothermia, hunger, etc., what do you think of this, the count that's always given, 45,000 people have been killed in Gaza since the war began in October 2023. What do you think the actual count might be, given all of these reasons?
It's very hard to make accurate estimates. You know, Alex DeWall just wrote a good blog post at the Tufts Peace Center that he runs. He's the leading historian of famine in the modern period. And he writes what he wrote, that it's extremely unlikely that fewer than 10,000 people have died. And he was hesitant to make any more from what are called indirect causes of war. And he was hesitant to make more predictions than that. But the if you look at the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification data, it's hard. You can't estimate that less than 60,000 people have died of starvation in Gaza. And that's the only data that's really available. There's nothing else. There actually was just a study published in a nutrition science journal. It just came across my desk yesterday. And I've requested it from our library, so I haven't been able to read it yet, so I don't know what it says. But the abstract was terrifying, saying that basically the entire population has lost weight, which, you know, Mimi and I have, having been there, we can definitely attest to that. But it's very likely that tens of thousands of people have starved to death in Gaza, many of them small children. But what's more important than the number is that we don't know. We're doing this to an entire population of child refugees, and we don't even know if we're starving tens of thousands of children to death. That's crazy. What kind of behavior is that?
Well, Dr. Mimi Sayed, let me get your response to that. In other words, you know, what the U.S. has been doing in all this time. They could have easily, as many have pointed out, pushed and made a ceasefire happen. That has not occurred. And now we have Trump coming in 3 weeks. He said if the hostages are not released by Inauguration Day, January 20th, all hell is going to break out. What do you imagine might happen then?
Oh, I mean, it needs to stop is the number one point. But there is absolutely no dignity left. And that's what I mean when I say humanity has ended. Froze is talking about malnourishment. Absolutely. Every single child has some sort of hypopigmentation. And, you and I both know as physicians, that's the number one sign of acute malnourishment. Children are displaying these signs all the time. And then when we talk about dignity, imagine, this population was not poor to begin with. The majority of people were well-to-do. They had professions like you and I do. They had education, 98% literacy right there. Overnight, their lives were changed. Imagine living in a tent that's made out of scraps in cold weather with about 20 other people. On so many levels, that's a violation of a person's dignity and basic human needs. And I spoke to so many people, so many women especially, that commented on, there's no menstrual pads.
I'm so sorry, Dr. Mimi Sayed. We're going to have to end it there. American emergency medicine physician who just left Gaza, and Dr. Firoz Sidwa, trauma surgeon who volunteered in Gaza. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm stoked. You stoked?
I'm stoked.
Just
I'm
so stoked.
You ready?
Yeah.